I'm Jay Michelson. I'm queer, I'm Jewish, and I'm proud of it. And I'm here to say that not only does it get better, it already is better for millions of religious LGBT people who see their sexuality not as a predicament, but as a gift. Who are we? Millions of people of all faith traditions who refuse the false choice between God and gay, between religion and love. We refuse to be defined by people who say that we don't exist or tell us that our love isn't real. And we're building communities for ourselves, religious and secular, mainstream and alternative, part of the straight world, and also apart from it. 6 years ago, I founded an organization called Nihirim, the name means lights, which now runs programs around the country for thousands of queer Jews, partners, and allies. We run weekend retreats, conferences, support groups, and parties. We have Orthodox Jews who are just coming out, and lifelong queers who are just starting to explore Judaism. And we're not waiting for straight people to tell us it's okay to be gay. It gets better because we make it better. So if you're queer and Jewish, mazel tov, now go and learn. Learn about your elders and ancestors, David and Jonathan, Gertrude Stein and Kate Bornstein, Evry Leader and Donna International, Leonard Bernstein and Tony Kushner. Learn about queer midrash and the five genders listed in the Talmud. And learn about yourself, because your identity is something to be celebrated.
Learn about queer midrash and the five genders listed in the Talmud.
Thank you. My name is Sydney Yeager, and I'm the Public Programs Coordinator at the Museum of Jewish Heritage, a living memorial to the Holocaust. I'm so pleased to welcome you all to Transgender People, the Nazi State, and the Holocaust. Here at the museum, we are dedicated to our mission of educating our diverse community about Jewish life and heritage before, during, and after the Holocaust. As part of that mission, our programs are meant to illuminate the stories of survivors, broader histories of hate, bigotry, and anti-Semitism through time, and stories of resistance against injustice. Today, we will be discussing the experiences of transgender and non-binary folks in pre-war and Nazi Germany. We have talked before about this, along with the Pink Triangle and gay experiences specifically. But as the rights, healthcare access, and really the very existence of trans people are being viciously curtailed at the whim of legislation in the United States and around the world, it's important to delve into this history. We're so pleased to be here with scholar Lori Marhofer, who will share perspectives, experiences, and language about a topic that each of us understands and connects to in different ways. It's tricky to talk about people in the past with contemporary language that didn't exist at the time. We talk about this often at the museum in our programs, exhibitions, and more. So we're so grateful to Lori and to all of you for navigating this with us. So now I'm going to introduce you all to our speaker. Lori is the John Bridgman Endowed Professor of History at the University of Washington. His work has been influential in international debates about the Nazi state and lesbians and transgender people, and in the public memory of the early gay rights movement, Magnus Hirschfeld, and the Weimar Republic. He is the author of two books, most recently a biography of Hirschfeld and his student Li Shu Tong, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Racism and the Making of Gay Rights, A Sexologist, His Student, and the Empire of Queer Love, and of a number of essays and articles on queer and trans histories.
In Berlin in this period, like the German government was just really tolerant in comparison to the government Germany had before the First World War, which was the Kaiserreich. So under the democratic regime, they really relaxed censorship. And relaxed censorship was like a key issue for trans and queer people, because before the internet, there weren't a whole lot of ways to find other people who were like you. There was people really isolated unless you could read a magazine or read a book and reach out to a community of people. This is Lotzi Hamm, who also went by Lothar. And Hamm was a really important organizer in trans and queer subcultures in Berlin in the 20s. And a lot of the work that Hamm did was through this magazine called Girlfriend. This is a picture from Girlfriend magazine, and in it, Hamm is holding up a sign that says, "Hooray, Girlfriend is back." And what had happened is the Weimar Republic had, they still had like a kind of relaxed censorship mode. So they had seized one issue of the magazine and suppressed it. And then it reemerged after that. That to us, that's kind of intolerable censorship, which I think is good. We should not tolerate such. But in comparison to the United States would not have allowed a magazine like this to be published at all, ever. So for the time period, like that's quite relaxed censorship. But it's also something that people fought against. So Hamm's point in this photograph is to say, you know, we're celebrating the fact that we have reemerged after this moment of censorship, and to like affirm the rights of queer and trans people to publish these magazines. Hamm identified initially as a lesbian, and then Hamm identified as a transvestite, and did a lot of organizing for people we would call trans men, for trans people who were masculine. Let me show you another image. This is another image of Hamm. Was kind of like, there's lots of photographs of Lotzi Hamm. I think Lotzi Hamm was kind of like the heart, the trans guy heartthrob of Berlin in the 1920s, like the dashing, right? sorry for the siren, baby. Okay. But also, like, just to underscore the importance of the magazines themselves, this is another a couple of images from Girlfriend magazine. You can see Lotzi Hamm on the back there. A lot of what Hamm did was to organize parties. Hamm organized a moonlit cruise on the Spree River through the middle of Berlin to an overnight party that sounded super fun. And all kinds of, like, there's a like a balls, masquerades. There was really like a very vibrant queer trans social scene going on. And this image on the left are all ads on the back of the magazine for different clubs. And you can see one of them is in Hamburg as well. And then that's the front too. So Girlfriend magazine was mostly for cisgender lesbians, and it published a lot of short fiction and essays and some photographs. And also had a transvestite section. If you scroll down, that that's the contents next to the photograph on the image on the right. You can see there's an item for transvestites coming out in this issue too. So it's joint cisgender, lesbian, trans, mostly trans women organizing through these magazines, but also Lotzi Hamm, trans guy. Okay, so super vibrant subcultures in Berlin in the 1920s, in part because of Hirschfeld's advocacy, but in part, like, I want to give credit to these people who are not quite as famous, like Lotzi Hamm, who really fought to create these subcultures. And also the people who fought to establish a democratic regime in Germany. That it was the democracy that made all this possible. Okay, so one of my favorite examples of like how open Berlin was in the 20s and the 30s is the El Dorado nightclub. The El Dorado, it was a cabaret. This is a real photograph of one of its locations. The sign means here is the right place to be. And I don't know if you could see, but like that image on the left. So that's the entrance. And there are these beautiful people painted on the entrance sign. And they look like maybe they're kind of winking, like they have a secret, right? I don't, is that, am I projecting that? I don't know. So El Dorado was famous in many countries as a place where if you, you know, an assumedly not transgender or cisgender, like cisgender people, you came to Berlin, you want to see the sights, you're going to see the famous buildings, you're going to see the famous nightlife. And like, if you're very daring, you could go to the El Dorado and see the transvestites who work there. It was famous for its trans performers, particularly for the beautiful trans women who danced there, stage performers, queer stage performers who weren't trans as well. Some beautiful like queer male dancers danced at the El Dorado. A lot of the dance was risque without a lot of clothing. There was a whole controversy in the Weimar Republic about naked dance, and the government eventually decided that you couldn't dance naked, but you could dance with what, you know, basically a bikini or some minimal covering, or you could be naked if you were completely still. It was one of these like, thing, you read the judicial decision, and the judge's tortured logic. But anyway, they got to this place where it was possible to be completely still on stage naked, but mostly what people did was to have like a minimal costume. So El Dorado like had stage performances, there was an orchestra. This is a photograph of the interior of El Dorado, people dancing. And it also had what was called taxi dancing, which some people in the audience may have heard of taxi dancing. I know my partner's grandmother was a taxi dancer during the Second World War and was kind of proud of it. So I have known what it was for a long time, but it's kind of a cross between being a dance instructor. I mean, I'll say for Grandma Cindy, it was the dance instructor, but for some people it could kind of veer a little bit into sex work. But it was like, you'd go to the club and you pay the dancer to dance with you. And these trans women were like beautiful and wearing evening gowns, and they were really good dancers, and you could pay for a dance. And that was like very exciting, right? So in part, the El Dorado, it's a little creepy because it's like making money off of curious tourists who are kind of gawking at like the gay people and the trans people. But it also was kind of awesome because it like created a lot of jobs for gay and trans people. And it also was a way for trans people to like showcase their performing abilities. A club like this in another country probably would have been shut down. And it was tolerated in Berlin. And the Berlin police had been super tolerant of gay and trans queer subcultures for a long time, but particularly under the Weimar Republic. This club is listed in guidebooks like that came out in England. People talk about, you know, you should really go see the El Dorado if you dare, you know, it's like a very risque kind of thing to do. So Germany, it's hard for us to wrap our heads around this because we know like what's gonna happen when Hitler comes to power, but in 1932, it was one of the best places in the world to be gay or transgender. So let's talk about, here's another example. This is the world's first lesbian bar guide, written by this woman, Ruth Rohlig, who was somebody who published a lot in the lesbian magazines and wrote this book, which you, if you're curious, you may be able to find a copy online, at least in German. It describes like about a dozen bars for women in Berlin. They're all different, and she has these kind of lavish descriptions of like the dress codes in the different bars and like the kinds of women who hung out there. And it's quite fascinating. But yeah, so I think when we think Germany, we think Nazi Germany often when you think the first half of the 20th century. But like this is the first lesbian bar guide that came out in the 20s in Berlin. You can see Magnus Hirschfeld wrote the foreword. Okay. So 1933, Hitler came to power in January. All of this changed. A lot of it came crashing down immediately. The Nazis, they did not like come to power because they were against gay people and trans people. Gay and trans people in the 1920s and 1930s, like we were not the kind of wedge issue that we became at the end of the 20th century and certainly today. I spent a lot of time as a graduate student looking at the newspapers around the time that Hitler came to power, and there's almost nothing about queer and trans people. It's just not a wedge issue. It's not something that a lot of people are talking about in public. Hitler came to power because of the Great Depression. So if you want to take away, you know, the unregulated American stock market crashed because of the greed of lots of people, and that caused a wave of global trauma. A third of Germans were unemployed, and a lot of those people went to the polls and voted for Hitler because they wanted a radical solution and they were comfortable with racism. So it's certainly not the case that like Berlin got too gay or too trans and then we got the Nazis. There's not a functional connection there. However, when the Nazis did come to power, they were kind of anxious to quickly make a point of cracking down on queer and trans subcultures. But so then, as you probably know, the Nazis had a lot of these symbolic book burnings right around the time that they took power, showing Germans how they were purging German intellectual life of the work of Jewish people, leftists, whether they were Jewish or not. And there was a big one in Berlin, right near the Opera House. And a big part of what was burned there was Magnus Hirschfeld's library from the Institute. And they actually burned a bust of Hirschfeld. There's a press photograph of like them carting this statue of his head and throwing it on the fire. It was a super public repudiation of everything that he stood for because he was Jewish, and also because he was a leftist on questions of sex, and because he was a defender of especially of gay people, but also of trans people. So for all of those reasons, like, he was a real target and his institute was a target. They also shut down, you know, a lot of the public cultures that people had enjoyed. So this is the El Dorado nightclub after Hitler took power. And you can see that this is also like a press photograph. They've put up swastikas on the nightclub. You can see the old sign underneath that big sign over those police officers that says vote Hitler list one. So it's like electioneering for Hitler. So pretty chilling for queer and trans people, right? They shut down all the magazines. A lot of the subcultures had to go underground. People felt isolated, people felt scared. Hirschfeld was not in Germany when this happened. He was in exile. He had been out of the country since 1930, and he didn't think it was safe to come back. But he actually was in a movie theater to see a movie, and there was a newsreel in front of the regular feature, and he saw newsreel footage of the Institute being destroyed. So he kind of witnessed this in exile. And it must have been terrifying for people, right, to go from this moment when everything was so open and tolerated to like a really different regime. Okay, so let me spend the rest of my time kind of talking about like how people navigated that. Okay, so the Nazi state went after trans people. I'm doing a project on police files, and I've gathered a number of police files from different archives around Germany where trans people got into trouble with the police. This is really different from Weimar. There is some police harassment in Weimar. I don't want to like super. I think I'm sometimes when I talk about Weimar, it sounds like a gay and trans paradise. I mean, there are cases of people running into police trouble, but they're few and far between, and the level of trouble is like very different. So we're not talking about big prison sentences. We're talking about like maybe you'll get a fine. For cross-dressing, and often people were protected by those certificates. So the certificates, which were so important, are generally not respected by the Nazi police, or they're explicitly revoked. I'm going to talk about a case in a little bit where the cops actually went to the person in question and took the certificate away. but also, like again and again, I've seen in files that police either revoke them or don't respect them. So the person gets arrested for cross-dressing. She says, "I have a certificate." The police are like, "What certificate? We don't, you know, who cares? Like, we're not doing that anymore." the laws that they used against trans people were two, the first two laws you see here. So that's paragraph 183 and paragraph 360, which both are basically public indecency laws. The United States had similar laws in a lot of states, as did a lot of other countries. And they're not only used against trans people, but they are used against trans people. They're anti-cross-dressing laws. Of course, trans people, when we're dressed in the clothing that is the clothing of our own like gender, we're not cross-dressed, as Susan Stryker, the historian, said. We're just dressed. I love that. But yeah, so using, however, like in the law, that's considered cross-dressed, and you could be arrested for it. And there are, I have seen cases where particularly trans women were arrested for cross-dressing. The other law that was used, again, in particular against trans women, it was paragraph 175. If you've like come to other lectures or read about this, you maybe already know about paragraph 175. It was Germany's national law against what was called sodomy, or what would we would call consensual adult male-male sex, was illegal. Lots of countries had laws against male-male sex. Also a number of countries had gender-neutral laws against same-sex sex. So Austria, for example. So in some cases, like lesbian sex was also criminalized, but in a lot of countries, these laws were gender specific to male-male sex. The United States had laws on the books until 2003, when the Supreme Court struck them down. The paragraph 175 predates the Nazi state, but the Nazis rewrote it and made it harsher. And often trans women, when they got into trouble with the police, they would be accused under paragraph 175. Although they were women, the Nazi police refused to see them as women. And if they were having relationships with men, then those would be construed as gay relationships and they could be charged. Okay, so let me talk through just a number of the cases that I've found to kind of show you the level of violence, but also the kinds of twists and turns that can happen. The first is a case of a woman. I don't know what her, I know she had a woman's first name that she used, and I don't know what it was, so I'm just going to refer to her by her initial. Her name was H. Böde. She lives in Hamburg. She had a transvestite certificate under Weimar. When the Nazi state came in, the police no longer respected that certificate, and she had a number of arrests and convictions in charges for cross-dressing and also for having sexual relationships with men. The arrest that led to her murder took place when one night she went out to a bar with her aunt. Böde was dressed as a woman and passed as a woman at the bar. They got chatting with some soldiers who had just come back from the war in Poland. This is early on in the Second World War. And they were all having drinks together at a table. And then suddenly one of the soldiers jumped up and said, "Oh, wait, you're not a woman, you're a man in woman's clothing." And the soldiers grabbed her and brought her to a police officer who was walking a beat, and she was arrested. And she was eventually charged under paragraph 175. And they also brought a cross-dressing charge against her. She had several convictions already. So the police decided to escalate her case. They called in a medical examiner. The medical examiner wrote this like horrible report where he finds that she's a transvestite and a homosexual and a psychopath and all kinds of bad things. And they start using this kind of language in her file, which is always a really bad sign for people. So at one point they wrote in her file, quote, this is the police writing about her. It cannot be denied that a man going about in women's clothing is not in keeping with prevailing concepts of discipline and morality. Under the current state, a state of manly outlook, it is not permissible that a man counterfeit the other sex by wearing women's clothing. So to me as a historian, this was really interesting because they're referring directly to the fascist state here, the state of manly outlook. In fascism, like male dominance and masculinity were really important. So what they're saying is like, look, we have fascism. We can't have this kind of stuff behavior going on. We can't have a trans woman. It's in direct violation of like what fascism is. So we have to do something about her. And indeed, they decided to send her to a concentration camp. They sent her to Buchenwald, where she was murdered in 1943. So on the one hand, what I want to emphasize is, like, this is pretty horrible and sad. Yeah, this is pretty horrible and sad, right? Okay, let me give you another case. Lydie Backroft, Bodhi Ashton has done really interesting work on her. And if you want to know more, please like Google her and Google Bodhi's name. And you can see he did a talk about her and he has a piece coming out about her. Her file is just remarkable because it's so rich. We have a photograph of her. This is her. There are essays that she wrote about her life that Bodhi talks about. We have a really good sense of like what her personality was like. And she was also like just a really remarkable, super savvy, super tough, super determined woman. She also had a transvestite certificate under Weimar. She made her living selling sex in Hamburg. And she writes in the file about like being content and even happy with sex work as a way to make a living. She apparently was like really good at it, had lots of clients, supported herself. Her clients, there's lots of evidence in the file that her clients thought that she was a cisgender woman. She ran into trouble with police on a number of occasions. And this is something that I've seen across the files I looked at, that like when trans women were doing sex work, they were even more at risk of police violence, which is true today. As well. Backroft had a number of arrests, and finally they determined that similar to Bodhi's case, they start using this horrible language about her and determine that she's unredeemable and she's a danger to the Nazi state and the people's community, the Nazi community. And they sent her to Mauthausen, where she was murdered also. So again, like a pretty sad story. But I think it's really important to just remember this violence. It's remarkable to me, but until some, not that many years ago, we weren't talking about the murder of trans women in the concentration camps at all. And both Backroft especially had been written about by historians, and Bode too, actually, but sometimes historians would identify them as men. As gay men, which they were not. They both are pretty clear about that. The police actually would interrogate you about your gender identity. If they could figure out that you were a transvestite, that was like more concerning to them than just being gay. So there's a lot of paperwork in the file about it. And you can see like what people told the police. And Backroft was like super forthcoming. At one point she said, "My sense of my gender is fully and completely that of a woman." And there's lots of evidence that she lived her life as a woman as much as she possibly could, given that the police were constantly harassing her. Okay, here's a third case. So it's Pride Month, and I also want to talk about trans survival. And so I'm really happy to be able to talk about Toni Simon, who's somebody whose file has like recently come to my attention. I'm sorry, I don't have a photograph of her. She was from Essen, and so I put this photograph up of Essen synagogue, and I do want to talk about like the role that Judaism and race plays in all of this. Essen had a famous and really beautiful synagogue that was destroyed during Kristallnacht, but it was restored in the 1980s, and you can go and see it today. This is a postcard. Toni Simon was not Jewish, nor was Backroft, nor was Bode. So none of the three trans women I've talked about so far were Jewish. They were all quote unquote Aryan. Okay, so Toni Simon also had a transvestite certificate under Weimar. And she even published an essay in one of the, in Girlfriend magazine. Like she was somebody who wrote an essay for the magazine. So it's so pretty cool to find a person who's not famous, like so well documented. By the time the Nazis came to power, she'd been living as a woman for quite a few years. The police in Essen already didn't like her because even before Hitler took power, she was running an underground bar where trans and gay people hung out, when Hitler took power, they went to her and explicitly took away her transvestite certificate and told her she could no longer wear women's clothing. They forbade her to do so in public. So that was like a forced detransition for Toni Simon. She responded by leaving town and fleeing the country. She lived abroad for a while. Then she came back. She spoke out against the Nazi regime at one point when she was living in Stuttgart. She was tried under there was a Nazi era law against criticizing the regime. She was tried and convicted, served a year in prison. She was released from prison. And it seemed like she was gonna make her way back to Essen finally. And there's lots of paperwork in the file. The Essen police got a report that Toni Simon was coming back to Essen after she'd been released from prison. And at that point they had had enough. So there are these reports back and forth where the Gestapo is like, we're gonna arrest her, we're gonna send her to a camp. And again, they start using this very frightening language about her, right? I gave it to you on the slide here. In addition to her transvestite inclinations, she's a pronounced homosexual. She has always promoted homosexuality. That was like running the underground bar. She'll do so in the future. She's a danger to young people. They sound familiar. A concentration camp is absolutely necessary. Okay, so what's so wonderful about this file is that it ends there. So usually if the person gets arrested, there's arrest paperwork, and then there's camp paperwork, and then there's like a report of the death. Toni Simon's file just ends. So I took her name and I ran it through the International Tracing Service. Thank you to the people there who helped me, which is a really super useful collection of documents from the camp system. If you Google ITS, International Tracing Service, and they will turn up. You can actually run a search yourself and then they can run a more advanced search, and there's nothing on her. I have her date of birth too, so she's not in that system. So I am somewhat confident to say that I think she made it. She was biking towards Essen and they were gonna arrest her, and she must have biked in the other direction. so wonderful, you know, hopefully somebody who survived, but who ran a serious risk because she was trans.